Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Logan Kearsley is an experienced software engineer with a history in the education, solar power, and entertainment industries. He earned a BS in computer science and an MA in linguistics, both from Brigham Young University, and is currently employed as a software engineer at Idaho National Laboratory. He blogs about conlangs and xenolinguistics, and he has a YouTube channel where he reads Beowulf. Topics discussed include computational morphology, animal communication, networking, lexicography, conlangs, xenolinguistics, and typology. The links to Logan's LinkedIn account, his blog, and to other resources mentioned are in the show notes. Today, I would like to welcome Logan Kearsley to the podcast. Logan, thank you so much for agreeing to chat with me today.
Thanks for having me.
You are quasi in tech, shall we say, and you've done a lot of other interesting things. So I want to hear about your story, but the first question that I always ask people is, how did you find out what linguistics was and decide that you wanted to study it?
That is a difficult question to answer because it happened so long ago. So I'm not really sure there was one tipping point. There is probably a moment where I first heard the word linguistics for the first time in my life. And I don't know which moment it was. My paternal grandfather was a high school German teacher. Both of my grandmothers had English degrees. My grandma was a high school English teacher. Several of my aunts and uncles are also high school English teachers, mostly now retired. My dad was in the Air Force and taught French at the Air Force Academy. And for several years of my childhood, we lived in Belgium because that's where the Air Force stationed him. So I was aware that other languages exist and theoretically studied French in the local American school, picked up random words of Dutch or technically Flemish because that's what all the advertisements were on TV. But I was what I now recognize as being very typical for a child, not at all interested in putting forth the effort to speak anything that I didn't have to. So after we moved back to the U.S. and, you know, my brain had grown slightly more, then I thought, dang, I should have paid more attention to French while I was in a French-speaking country, and now I'm really bad at it. So I've got all this, you know, family background related to language teaching and foreign languages. And then at some point, I started reading Lord of the Rings. I'm not sure anymore if it was Lord of the Rings or Dune that really got me interested in how other languages work. There's certainly a lot more of that going on in Lord of the Rings. I read Dune fairly early as well. So it was one of those. Then of course you get to the appendices and, and you find out that actually all the elven languages came first and that the only reason the story exists was to have some place to show off the poetry. And so I thought, oh, wait, like that's a thing that a person can do. Like you can just construct a language. So then I wanted to know how all the bits and pieces worked. And basically I was the kind of child who would occasionally sit down and read the dictionary. I did not read the dictionary from cover to cover, but it was, you know, fun to find weird words and just flip through and learn vocabulary that was too advanced for my age. Mm-hmm. So I found the SIL Glossary of Linguistics Terms, which I'm pretty sure is still on the web, and just devoured that and essentially started teaching myself linguistics via learning the definitions of all of the terms. So if there's a term for it, this must be a thing that is a thing that languages have or that languages do. And so I was interested as a hobby in studying linguistics through middle school and high school. My middle school actually had a survey class where you could you couldn't take a single foreign language until eighth grade, but before that they had an intro survey class where you'd spend like 1 month each on a bunch of different languages, I guess to help kids decide what option they liked best. Even though not all of the languages that were covered in that course were actually available as options later on. But that was a fun elective credit. So we did a little bit of Latin and a little bit of Russian, German, French. I don't remember what all the ones were in there. Those are the ones I do remember. And then I started studying French in eighth grade. Because I felt like I should, because, you know, my dad's a French teacher and we lived in Belgium and, and that went pretty well. I did good in French class, but then high school started and they had a lot more options, which is very unusual for high schools in the US, but, we had French, Spanish, Latin, Japanese, Mandarin, and Russian, and maybe Italian. And I'm not sure about Italian, but at least those first six. And so, you know, being a rebellious teenager, I thought, I don't want to study French anymore, and I can't study Spanish or German, because those are like the common languages that everybody does. And I don't really want to do Japanese or Mandarin, because just learning to write those seems like it would be a major pain. So I'll do Russian just to be annoying about it. So yeah, then I took 4 years of Russian in high school, and unfortunately, they did not have an AP linguistics course, and there still is not an AP linguistics course. So after high school, going into college, I had a bunch of different ideas of things that I might want to do. And so I ended up picking my major based on how many AP transfer credits I could get.
Very practical.
Yeah. So I ended up majoring in computer science, and took a minor in linguistics, but because there was no AP linguistics, so I wasn't going to have any transfer credits for that major. But there's a professor, now retired, there was a professor at BYU who worked with my dad at the Air Force Academy. And ran the ArcLight lab, which I was required to memorize the acronym for, but it's been a while, so I'm not going to tell you what it is in case I get it wrong, because that would annoy him. But the ArcLight lab was basically tech support for the linguistics and foreign language departments. So we developed a lot of custom software for people doing PhDs in instructional psychology or language teaching specifically. And we developed classroom aids, so like annotated reading software, and video streaming software with multilingual subtitles, so teachers could like take clips and put custom subtitles and captions. I have very strong opinions about captions and subtitles now because of this job. To focus on whatever they needed for class. They sent a film crew to Egypt and Syria to get interview material of natural native speech for the BYU Arabic program. And then we spent years annotating and transcribing all of that. So the whole time I was majoring in computer science and minoring in linguistics and being constantly exposed and getting paid for figuring out how to profitably mix the two.
Yeah. Was that all students doing all the work in ArcLight?
Yep.
That's amazing. Like that's the best linguistic training that you could possibly have. You know, it's like field work and then the applicability of field work in real time to teaching. That's incredible. Amazing.
Yep. All students and one professor, Mike Bush, who was officially a French professor. He founded the lab and then everybody else was students. When I graduated, then I did not want to go look for a new job. So I applied to the master's program and got into the master's for linguistics and kept working at the lab for that whole time. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, there's really much interesting to say about being in a master's program. It was 3 years of doing research and writing a paper and writing software. But I learned a heck of a lot more formal linguistics than I did just taking a minor.
Yeah, for sure. Was there something specific you were focusing on as part of your master's work, like an area or a topic? What was the topic of your final product?
Yeah, so it was computational morphology. Mm-hmm. It turns out BYU has a pretty good background in computational morphology. Like Ken Beasley did a lot of foundational work in finite state morphology for Arabic. Mm-hmm. So I built on some of his stuff. Specifically, I was looking at the indeterminacy of word boundaries in text across different languages. And I developed an algorithm based on finite state morphology to automatically parse out boundaries with potential unknown words. And then all of that became completely obsolete like 2 years after I finished. So you can go read my master's thesis if you want. You can download it from the BYU website. I get a report every month of updated how many people have downloaded my thesis. And people are still doing it. I don't know why, because it is way behind the state of the art now, but it was cool at the time. And I have since met exactly one person who said, "Wait, are you that Logan Kersley? I re-implemented your word boundary parsing algorithm for an undergrad project." And I was like, "Oh, cool. I've had an impact on the world. At least once.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, it's small steps forward. Everybody has to do a little bit of work and then we move on from it. So you were part of the foundation. Yep. Let's say that you were part of the foundation. Yep. That's really cool. Okay. So you're doing this work. You're in the master's program. Mm-hmm. When you finished your master's, were you thinking that you might stay in academia or were you pretty set on getting a job in industry somewhere?
If I could have stayed in academia, I would have. But it was pretty clear fairly early on that that was going to be difficult. Because if I wanted to, like, if I wanted to become a professor, I'd have to go move somewhere else yep. for my PhD. Because, you know, it doesn't look all that great if you get all 3 degrees from one institution. Mm-hmm. And I don't like moving, so I didn't want to do that. And there weren't, like, any open positions at either of the universities in around Provo mm-hmm. at the time for a, you know, a guy with a master's degree. So they didn't let me keep the Arclight job when I wasn't a student anymore.
Yeah.
I was the longest tenured employee in that lab over its entire existence. Mm-hmm. It's not there anymore because Mike Bush retired, but everybody else worked there for less time than me because they were less less averse to moving out of state, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a difficult thing. This is something that a lot of folks have said as I've talked to them. When that time came to make the decision, it's not just what do I want to do? It's like, what is practical for me to do mm-hmm. that works with the life that I want to have? And, you know, even yep. if you had gone to get your PhD somewhere else, there's no guarantee that that's where you would have stayed to teach, right? Like
exactly.
you could have moved your whole life to Alaska or something. And then it's like, well, no jobs here. Yep. Got to move back somewhere else. So it's really difficult and it's getting harder because there are so few jobs.
Oh, yeah.
Now.
Yeah. Actually, my sister lives in Anchorage. So they did pack up and go to Alaska.
Yeah.
But and she speaks French, but neither she nor my brother-in-law are linguists. They moved there for civil engineering.
So you finished your master's, you knew you were going to get a job. So what
yep.
steps did you take to actually look for your new career out of grad school?
So right out of grad school, because of all that time I spent in the lab, mm-hmm. I already had a relationship with a guy named Corey, who was the CEO of an ESL tech company in Salt Lake. Mm-hmm. They're not around anymore, which becomes relevant, but it was called Movie Mouth. Their product was very similar to a lot of the stuff that we had been developing for classroom use. It's basically, the idea was that you learn languages faster if you have natural native input as opposed to artificial examples that mm-hmm. are constructed for instructional purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted to use popular movies as a basis for instruction to get students interested because they'll watch the movies anyway, dubbed or subtitled or whatever. And so we'll take things that people want to see that give them intrinsic motivation and turn them into language learning exercises. So automatically transcribe the audio in the films and then process it to chop it up into scenes and identify where there's certain vocabulary items in use or certain grammatical constructions so that you can then build a lesson around those. So it was a really cool idea, but unfortunately it was not a very profitable idea. So they went out of business a couple of years after I had graduated. And I ended up getting just a plain old no linguistics involved, except peripherally because people knew that that was my degree. And so I got to talk about it with colleagues sometimes.
Uh-huh.
Doing software for a residential solar power company. So I worked on computer-aided design software for designing solar power systems and embedded software for power monitoring devices and stuff like that. And that was reasonably fun, and it paid me good money. But that's kind of somewhere in there is where I came up with my favorite Antanaclasis, to pull out the 50 cent words, that computer science makes me money and linguistics mm-hmm. makes me happy.
Yeah, I saw that in your LinkedIn and I was like, that's amazing. I love it. It's yep. so good. Yep.
Yep. So that was a good job for a while. And then they got acquired and did massive layoffs. Mm-hmm. So I fell back on university connections again. Mm-hmm. And got my next job with VidAngel in Provo, because several people who had previously been my professors or students that I knew while I was in university had also gone to work there. Mm-hmm. And so I got to make a little bit more use of my linguistics education in that context. For anybody who does not know mm-hmm. what VidAngel is or what they do, they've now mostly pivoted to being Angel Studios. So it's mm-hmm. an indie film company. But originally they did automated editing of popular films, which also ties into what I was doing for Movie Mouth, to remove various classes of potentially objectionable material. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you want to see an R-rated movie, but you don't want to see the sex and hear the swears, then you can watch it through VidAngel and they'd cut it all out. Mm-hmm. So there was a little bit of computational linguistics, natural language processing stuff there to do, because manually annotating everything would have been super expensive. Yeah. For that kind of application. So again, we needed to be able to do speech recognition in order to accurately align subtitles to mm-hmm. the film, so that you could then they didn't trust the automatic speech recognition to be completely mm-hmm. accurate, mm-hmm. But if you had existing subtitles, which most movies do, then you could use automatic speech recognition to align words with timestamps at the mm-hmm. you know subtitle level, and then use that transcription data to identify portions of the film that need to be clipped out.
Just to stop for a second, that's so interesting that you worked there. I knew about that company. I'd heard uh-huh. about it from some other linguists, and I also knew because of the studio that it is now, were the producers mm-hmm. of Sound of Freedom, which was a very large movie that came out, last year, the year before? It was like really big, yep. Yep. For an indie movie especially. And when I heard about VidAngel, I really wondered, like, how are they doing this? Do they really have people sitting there, like, with the watching it on their computers and noting down every single timestamp? And I figured mm-hmm. there must have been something in the background that was helping them, and it's extremely cool that you yep. worked on that.
Yeah, they did have people reviewing it. Like, they were not going to trust an automated system to get it perfect. But
yes.
But yeah, there was a lot of work on automated assistance.
Yeah. Oh, super cool. I'm so glad you mentioned that. It, you know, that kind of work also ties to a lot of other folks that I've talked to, some of whom do captioning work, like that is their mm-hmm. job, is to work on captioning, yep. but also yep. on transcriptions, like things like court transcriptions and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So the technology of automatic speech recognition and parsing things and morphology, it has multiple instantiations of work in places where you might not expect it, but it's becoming yep. more and more important, I think, as time goes on. And you absolutely need a linguist for this stuff. Like mm-hmm. you just cannot do it without somebody who knows about linguistics, because, you know, software engineers, people who don't have training can only get to a certain level of accuracy before it just falls off, because you have to know about language and how people actually yep. use language.
Yep. And you do not trust the automatic AI transcriptions, right. especially on technical topics or when you're using a lot of foreign words.
Absolutely.
They come up with some really funny stuff.
Yeah. Oh, and even slang, you know, like normal slang that people use. Anybody who watches the automatic captioning on YouTube or TikTok or Instagram, you will know, right? It comes up with wild, wild stuff. My favorite thing, sorry, just as an aside, is I watch a lot of YouTube channels that have cats. And when the automatic captioning is on, it will frequently assign words to what the cats are saying when they meow, which I absolutely love. It thinks the cat is
going like
hello or here or hey. It's like, well, maybe that is what they're saying. I don't know. But it's very funny that it doesn't parse it as meow. It parses it as a real English word. Very funny.
Okay. That's going to get me off on my first major tangent.
go ahead.
Before
please.
I continue with the career explanation. So in parallel to all of this, which will become relevant later, I had been helping to run a science fiction and fantasy symposium, conference, convention thing for over a decade. It's LTUE, which stands for Life, the Universe, and Everything. happens in Provo every February. So I had become and have continued to become acquainted with a lot of people in the creative industries, lots of authors and editors and filmmakers and artists and so on. There is this one particular author who is reasonably successful, but I don't know how mainstream she is. So the general audience may or may not know anything about her, but Mary Robinette Kowal. Anyway,
I know her. I know all about her. Yes, she's awesome.
Good.
She's great.
Yeah. So she frequently posts videos of her pets that use word buttons to communicate. And cats are apparently a lot better at it than dogs, or at least her cat is better at it than her dog. But they can actually have surprisingly sophisticated conversations, despite the fact that they lack the anatomy to produce human language normally. Spoilers, foreshadowing, whatever you want to call it, I have been really into research on animal communication recently. There's been a lot of stuff going on in that field just in the last few years.
Yeah, absolutely. That particular area, we'll just keep going on this aside because I'm interested in this too. It goes in stops and starts. And I think what we're learning is both that most animals are capable of far more sophisticated communication than we think. But also at the same time, animals are capable of taking cues from humans way better than we think. And it becomes really hard then to figure out, like, are they really communicating or are they really just responding to the cues that people don't realize that the animals are picking up from them? So parsing that out becomes really very thorny. And again, you need a linguist for a lot of that stuff.
That part of that is why I'm really excited about some of the more modern, you could call them corpus studies that have been done on natural animal communication. There's this big collaboration to set up hydrophones and just record whale song and whale calls all over the world, and there's no humans around. They're not being cued. So this is like pristine data. But then you've got to ask, okay, but if there weren't humans around cueing anything and you didn't have videos, like there's no context, what the heck can you possibly do with this? And there's a particular bit of technology that I have not had any involvement in developing. I would love to if somebody would pay me for it, but my career did not go there. But there's this thing called zero-shot learning. And the idea is if you take a huge corpus of human language, then you can produce these word vector embedding models that, without being explicitly trained, seem to be able to figure out semantic relations between words purely based on distributional patterns. So you might have encountered the basic word embedding thing is fairly old, well established by now. So you might have heard of stuff where, like, you can ask the model for what is the difference between king and queen, and it'll spit out female or something. Or you can say, you know, take king, subtract man, add woman, and it'll come out with queen. Or take Washington, D.C., subtract USA, add France, and it'll spit out Paris. Because it knows that. It doesn't know to call the relation capital city, but it knows that that relation exists. And so the idea is you can do that with two different languages and then try to match up the shape of the collections of word vectors between two languages and use that to translate. So it is absolutely bizarre that that works. But people have done it between English and French. And I saw a presentation a while ago by a research group that was trying to do it with English and ASL. So one of the potential things that we could do with animal communication is collect enough whale song that does not have human cueing to mess it up. Run that through a vector embedding learning model, and then just see, does the shape of the higher dimensional vector space that comes out look anything at all like a human language? And if it does, then you could do the thing, match them up, and then try to use that to assign probable definitions to whale words or any other animal that you collect a sufficient corpus of. There's really no way, I think, to predict whether or not that will work at this point. It's an experiment that needs to be done, so we find out whether or not it does work. But it's good enough for science fiction. If somebody wants to write a book where that's how you learn how to talk to aliens, then now you've got something to put behind the universal translator trope.
That's amazing. I did not know about that. And I agree. I think we should be running all the experiments we possibly can on different types of animal communication, because, you know, we're bound to figure some stuff out eventually. It's just a matter of trial and error, and we just got to keep trying. Wow. Oh, extremely cool. Okay. Good tangent. Love it. Let's wrap up your career stuff. So, eventually you went to the dreaded Amazon. I'm joking. But then I really want to hear about where you are now. So talk about how you made those transitions.
Okay. So, COVID happened, and then there was a lot of remote jobs. Again, I hate moving. I never wanted to leave. I moved to Provo for college, and I would have been happy to just stay in the same house for the rest of my life. So I figured I'm never going to get one of those high paying, awesome tech bro jobs with, you know, Netflix or Microsoft or Amazon or anything. But then suddenly everybody was hiring remote. So. So my wife found a job listing for Amazon and told me that I should apply for it. And so I did. And then I got the job, and that paid a lot more than I had ever made before. So I took the job. There was really I mean, I can stretch and say, like, a lot of the algorithms that I learned about for natural language processing turn out to be useful in other areas of technology. My formal education was not wasted in that sense, but I was not doing linguistics at Amazon. A couple of years into that, they decided that everybody could work in an office again, and then everybody should work in an office again. And then within the span of 6 hours, I went from being in a meeting where they said, don't worry, if you got hired remote, you can stay remote. Everybody's jobs are safe for at least the next year. And then another meeting where they said, actually, never mind, you need to move to Seattle in 6 months or less. And I did not want to move to Seattle. I did end up moving to Idaho Falls because my wife did not want to stay in Utah for the rest of our lives. And in fairness, we had a small house that was not big enough for all of the kids that we had at that point. So my dad, being in the Air Force, eventually retired, and both of my parents are from Idaho, so they retired back here. So we moved here to be close to Grandma and Grandpa, which has been great. And this is probably the last move that we will ever do, if we can help it. But conveniently, Idaho Falls also hosts the Idaho National Laboratory. And my dad had been trying to convince me that I need to come work for INL for years at this point, but I didn't want to move. But now he had already moved, so it was an option. And I said, I don't want to move to Seattle. I guess I'll apply for a job at INL. And yeah, so I did, and it worked. Well, technically it didn't work. I didn't actually get an interview for any of the positions that I specifically applied for. But my dad gave my resume to his neighbor, who is an administrator at INL, and he passed it around, and somebody decided that my resume looked good enough to call me. So networking, it works.
Networking, yeah. So, I mean, can't stress it too much. We say it every time. You never know where it's going to come from, right? You can send it out, but it often ends up being that unexpected connection from your parents or people you know or people you went to school with. And, you know, you talked about how the jobs that you got out of college were because it was people that you knew when you were in college. So it's so important to maintain those networks, to keep up with people, even if it's just on LinkedIn, to know that people you might have something in common with, or they're following you, or you're following them. It's just invaluable. There is nothing that can replace it.
So now I am at a national lab, and it's a good thing I have that computer science degree. And yeah, we don't, this is another job where I'm not really using linguistics explicitly. I am using a lot of skills that I got by being in grad school. We do, well, we do a lot of different stuff. INL is a huge lab that works on tons of different things. And the structure of the work environment is very different from what I was used to anywhere previously. It's not like you get hired to do one job and then you just get a salary for doing that job. It's more you get hired because you are a competent individual who can probably get things done. And then you find people who need things done and can allocate budget to cover your salary. I'm sure there are people who get hired normally, like secretaries and whatnot, but you know, the engineers and researchers and, you know, STEM people, that's basically how it works. So at the moment, I am mostly working on designing mesh protocols for cognitive radio net for distributed cognitive radio networks, which I mean, I can explain what all those words mean if you want, but it's nothing to do with linguistics.
I think the bigger point, and I've heard a lot of other people say this, is that a lot of the training that you get as a linguist is very broadly applicable in situations mm-hmm. like yours. So the things that you learn as a linguist, especially when you do field methods, and it sounds like the ArcLight experience was like this for you too, you learn how to manage projects, right? You learn mm-hmm. how to do experiments. You learn how to collect data. You learn how to analyze data. And those aren't, you know, they're specific to linguistics when you learned them, but you can take those skills and then apply them to any kind of job where you have to manage projects and look at data and set up experiments and all that stuff. So that's the core of it. Like, linguistics has these incredible transferable skills. Most of the social sciences do. Linguistics in particular is really good for anything that's dealing with, you know, that kind of data, language-based data. So it sounds like that's what you're doing now. You're taking all those skills and you're applying them in this new arena.
Yep. But I did actually have a good conversation a couple of days ago where I realized there is a very specific subset of all of the things that I studied across 9 years of 2 degrees and working in a lab, which is, I think studying lexicography has made me much better at technical writing.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Cool.
And so I would encourage any lexicographers to see if they can get jobs doing technical writing at tech companies, so that all of their documentation does not suck. Because engineers are terrible at writing documentation.
Yeah. Yep. This is a known fact. One of my best friends was a technical writer, and she would show me sometimes the things that she had to work with, and it was insane. It's a difficult point, because when you're an engineer and you're designing this stuff, you have so much assumed knowledge, and it seems sometimes you're like, oh, I don't have to explain this. Of course they're going to know what I'm talking about. And of course they don't know what you're talking about. So trying to make it explicit is really hard. And you absolutely need a third party to come in and go, okay, let's be super explicit about what you're trying to say.
Yeah. If I have not written down 6th grade level definitions of all of the terms, then me in 6 months is going to hate me now, because he doesn't know what I was talking about.
Yeah, exactly. That's that's great. So you have this very steady job now. Does it feel like that's a place where you're going to stay now for a while?
With what is currently going on in the public sector, that's a little sketchy. But I have been assured by people who have been there a lot longer that we will get through it. And INL is the kind of place where people tend to stick around for a long time. Yeah. Last month I went to a retirement party for a guy who had been there 40 years.
Wow. So
if I never have to do another job search again, I will be happy.
Yep. No, I totally get it. Yeah. It feels like that, right? Especially now when things are so uncertain and it's unclear how much funding is going to come from the federal government, like for anything. It's nice to have a little bit of security. So in addition to that, though, I really want you to tell me about the Beowulf thing, because that looks really fun.
Okay. That'll be a good segue into all of the other linguistics stuff that I've been doing in parallel with getting paid. I've been thinking about doing something with YouTube for a long time. But actually I need to back up, because I started out with writing a blog. And blogs are just not as much of a thing these days as they used to be. So therefore, I had been thinking for a while about getting into doing stuff on YouTube. I've got a bunch of other acquaintances who do Lingcom on YouTube. And it's just like there's this emotional hump to get over starting a new medium. Like I'm really comfortable with writing. And it's not even an issue of like being on camera. I can be on camera. I can do interviews. I can appear on other people's shows, whatever. It's just actually doing the thing has some activation energy to it. And so I just never done it. And I thought, okay, I've read Beowulf before in translation, and I would like to learn more about Old English. And Colin Gorrie has just come out with this great new Old English textbook that I had on pre-order. And so what if, like, I'm not going to understand it because I haven't, I don't yet know Old English, and Beowulf is not a starter text. I'm not going to be able to understand it, but I might as well practice pronouncing Old English and, you know, get fluent at it. And so if I just turn on my phone camera and record it while I am doing reading practice for a couple of minutes every day, I can put that on YouTube, and that's easy, and that'll get me over the hump. So I started on December 1st last year and read one line of Beowulf and put it up on YouTube. That turned out, unbeknownst to me, to be the same day that the Alfrich Homily Project YouTube channel was started. And I now know the guy who is doing that. He lives like 45 minutes away from me in Rexburg. But that's another YouTube channel that does readings of Old English texts, specifically Alfrich's homilies. And then goes through the translation and analysis. So those are fun. If you're a person like me. So that was a fun coincidence. We both started Old English projects at the same time. But yeah, every single day, starting on December 1st until it was just under 100 days. I don't remember what day I finished. But yeah, I did every single day recording a little bit of reading Beowulf just to practice Old English. So if you want to hear a good audiobook version of Beowulf, do not go listen to the Daily Beowulf playlist, because the whole point is that at the beginning of it, I suck. And by the end, people have told me that my pronunciation and reading fluency is actually passable. So I don't know how much to trust all of those people. They might have just been, you know, being nice, but it served my purposes. It worked, and I got a few people subscribing for reasons that I cannot fathom. But, you know, thank you to all the people who did. It's motivating.
Yeah, that's extremely cool. It's a way to hold yourself accountable, right? To make a commitment like that, to say like, I'm going to do this thing and I'm going to put it out there. I think that's awesome.
Yep. But backtracking a little bit, the blog came about because I had a friend that I met through the convention scene who suggested that, hey, I have a degree in linguistics and I know a lot about the publishing industry and I know a lot of authors, so I should write a book on linguistics for authors. And writing a book is hard, but writing a blog post is not. So so the blog started out as another one of those get over the activation energy things and start putting something out there. And in the meantime, I'm doing data collection. So I can go back and look at all of my blog posts later and have the material to turn it into a book. The actual turning it into a book still hasn't quite solidified yet, but I've got a lot of blog posts. So specifically what I've been doing is book reviews and mostly book reviews and movie reviews, TV show reviews, media reviews in general, of works that have something interesting going on. So it's I just titled it The Linguistically Interesting Media Index, because what exactly is interesting about it can vary. But if there's something linguistically interesting, then I want to figure out how they did it and try to condense that into a technique that can be explained and taught to someone else to replicate it. It turns out there are a few other people who are working in this area, but it is a very small group, and I'm pretty sure I know all of them. So at the recent Lingcom conference, I did a poster session about that blog, and I was shocked at how many people came by and said some variation of, oh, wow, this is really important, or you are doing God's work. Please keep this up. And I'm like, I mean, I just care about improving multilingual representation in fantasy books. Like, this does not feel as important as, you know, documenting community sign languages in South America or something. But hey, if you think it is, then great. I'm going to keep doing it.
Yeah, no, I get it. I you know, as you were mentioning before, the crossover between people who are like hardcore linguists and people who are really into, you know, science fiction and fantasy, there's a huge amount of overlap there. And I think for a lot of people, myself included, the appeal of a lot of science fiction and fantasy is in the language part, because it's a place where people can experiment and do different things, and you see different perspectives and you figure out, you know, there's a real joy to it. And people become extremely passionate about it. And laid on top of that is the fact that until pretty recently, genre writing, especially science fiction fantasy, was just not taken seriously. And now it is. And so now it's like, oh, people are finally paying attention to this cool thing that I've loved my entire life and getting interested in it. And that's delightful to see.
Yeah. So a random fun personal connection. My aunt by marriage's brother. So someone whom technically I do not have a named familial relationship with in English, but we're connected somehow, was actually the first person to get tenure and then say, screw it, I've got tenure, I can do whatever the heck I want, and spend the rest of his career, well, not the rest of it, he did other stuff, but spend a good part of his career legitimizing the literary study of Stephen King.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's super interesting. Cool.
So for reference, that is Michael R. Collings and his son, who is technically not my cousin, but we're good friends anyway. Michael Brent Collings is also now a highly successful indie horror author.
Amazing. Yeah, that's so cool. So many connections. It's great. I love it.
And incidentally, even though the book has not yet materialized, just writing this blog has actually gotten me a lot of good exposure in other places. So I've had one reporter contact me for an interview in the New York Times about multilingualism in video games. And I have done several convention conference presentations for writers on the bits of stuff that I have condensed so far on how to integrate linguistic knowledge into being a better writer. Not because I myself am a successful novelist, but like, here, I brought references. don't listen to me because I think this is a good idea. Listen to me because I can show you what this thing that is successful did. And and now you don't have to read 100 books to distill all of their techniques, because I did it for you. Check the references if you want. and I'm actually scheduled to do another one of those next weekend. So I haven't gotten a lot of like financially lucrative career progress out of that, but I have gotten a lot of networking and more community exposure through continuing to care about linguistics and write about it on my blog. And I have made a small amount of money, less than $1,000, but more than zero, doing consulting for Shoestone Publishing on a tabletop RPG. So that was fun.
Oh, cool. Very, very cool. Oh, that's just, it's so interesting to hear about all these things you have going on in addition to your quote unquote real job. And, and it feels like for linguists, you know, you have a passion for language and it's going to come out somewhere, whether it's part of your job or whether it's part of the hobbies that you have or the things that you're interested in. It's just so cool to hear that. And I really look forward to the book that I know you will eventually write.
Well, thank you. I said I wasn't going to wait to spring an important thing on you at the very end, but one last thing. So this is advice for anybody who is still in school. Your linguistics, your formal linguistics program, in my opinion, is almost certainly insufficient because I have yet to find one that makes everybody take a one credit colloquium class every semester and just sit down and read papers and grammars. Because another thing that was an outgrowth of COVID lockdown is a bunch of us got together and said, we need to do some kind of social activity. What would be more fun than reading a grammar of Inuktitut? So we, you know, got on Zoom for an hour a week and did a chapter each week of reading through a grammar of Inuktitut, which was amazing. And when we finished that one, we decided we didn't want to stop. So we picked another language. And that has kind of fizzled out recently, but if anybody else wants to join a linguistics reading group, hit me up. We'll start it up again. But for about four straight years, we just kept going, reading a chapter of a grammar every week. And then when we're finished one, go round robin, somebody in the group picks another one, keep going. And I have learned more about typology and other things, but especially typology, just from actually reading data about stuff that languages do than I ever did from 4 years of a minor and 3 years of of what do you call it, master's program. So out of that grew the podcast, because I was learning all this stuff about typology and like making connections in my head and thinking, oh, I could probably write a paper on this if Martin Hasselblad hasn't already. I looked at Lauren Gaughan's list of all of the linguistics podcasts, and there wasn't one on typology. So we started a podcast on typology to talk about papers. And that's very sporadic. I've been bad about releasing episodes lately. There's no kind of consistent release schedule because editing is hard. But I have a typology podcast on top of everything else. So you can go look that up on YouTube.
That's fantastic. Wow. So many balls in the air. Impressive. Very impressive. I think that's all the questions that I have. It sounds like it would be okay to put your LinkedIn profile link in the show notes in case people want to contact you about anything that you've talked about, correct?
Yeah, LinkedIn or email or Blue Sky or whatever.
Cool. And I will put links into many of the things that you've mentioned, your Beowulf channel and the typology podcast and your blog. So yeah, you'll have some new people who are going to be interested in all these things that you've done.
All right. Thanks.
Oh, thanks, Logan. This has been terrific.
Yep, it's been fun.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held two online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. V Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.